Okay, so this is Amelia Schoenbeck, and it is June 3rd, 2026, and I am here at The Hub at 47 North 5th Street in Hudson, New York, with Elliot Matos for the second part of our conversation for the Hudson Community Library of Voice and Sound. Elliot, do you want to reintroduce yourself?
Okay, my name is Elliot Matos. I am a resident of the Village of Casco and work and run a housing tenants rights group in Hudson, New York, the Hudson Casco Housing Coalition.
Cool, thank you. So I think as we left off our last conversation, we were just thinking about beginning by talking more about the dynamics of kind of connection and also difference in the sort of communities of Catskill and Hudson. And perhaps the way that change in Hudson has impacted Catskill as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a good place to begin.
Yeah, that's a great place to begin. I mean, when I was attending Bard College from 2020 to 2023, my researcher and my focus was about the history of the Black community and the migration that happened from the South to Hudson, to Catskill. And it was actually more to Catskill because Catskill had the factories. It had a lot of the brick factories and pocketbook factories. So there's a really strong connection as far as community with people of color for both Hudson and Catskill. And then, you know, I feel like the COVID-19 pandemic, I don't feel like it, but it's very true, the COVID-19 pandemic really shifted a lot for the Black and Brown communities here as we saw people fleeing urban areas like the city, especially white-bodied people. That displaced the Black and Brown communities here quite a bit. Recently, I was just doing research and trying to understand what percentage of the community in the Greene County and the Catskill identify as African American, Black, or Latino, and you know that percentage was only 11% to 13%. Where the numbers were in the 30%, before the pandemic. And so we see a displacement happening even currently as prices are rising for rents, for food, for gasoline, all the necessities that we need for our daily lives. And that's causing even more displacement. We're seeing people having to move to Albany or going back to the city or going back south. So it's kind of telling of this kind of wave that we're in right now. And, you know, as a managing director for a housing tenants rights group, we hear these stories and we're recording these stories, we're writing them down, we're taking notes of this, and we're asking our elected officials, in the local level and at the state level to please do something about this. But people don't really want to listen to that. They don't want to hear the truth about it. So it's a little disappointing in that regard. It's disappointing all around. But we're still out there fighting, and we're still out there, you know, giving it to the man, as they say, you know, and utilizing our voices even loudly than we have before. So that's where we're at.
Do you remind me which year you moved to the area, to Catskill?
So I had a house fire in the kind of, they call it an anti-squat, so in Amsterdam, New York, in March 2013. I want to say it was towards the beginning of April that I came back here. And then I was going back and forth to Amsterdam in the Netherlands to Catskill every 3 months until 2016. January 2016, I officially moved into Catskill. But I was going back and forth. I had gone in place with a friend's house, and I was going back and forth for those years to kind of close out my business. Also, to try to determine whether I really wanted to come back to the States or not. For me, it was kind of interesting because I had missed all of the Obama presidency years, and I came back for the Trump years. So that was a kind of a weird thing. But I mean, it's serendipitous at the same time because then shortly after we have the pandemic happen, and then I'm literally my life calling is just in my face, and it's like, okay, this is what you were meant to be here for. Mm-hmm. Not only just because of your ailing parents, but for the community. And doing what I was doing in a smaller scale in the Netherlands, doing it on a bigger scale with more intention. So, you know, I feel like it was meant to be, like the cards were in line for this. So,
what did you notice about the community in Catskill when you first got here?
The community in Catskill was, it's funny because I recognized for myself that I was a gentrifier in lots of ways because I had moved into this apartment building on Main Street that was torn down. It was not torn down. It was very teared down. The owners, the previous owners were not, they were absentee landlords. So they would live in the city and they did not take care of the place. So I got a little studio kind of apartment for really cheap from the new owners because they were still revamping all the apartments in there. But as they were revamping it in 2016, they were raising the rents just a little bit. I mean, I was paying $700 for the apartment when I moved in. I'm now paying close to $1,000. It has sold. It's changed. Exchanged hands now. There's a newer landlord, but so the Catskill, the village of Catskill, was quite poor when I came in some regards. It was slowly changing, but from my understanding, from listening to people and from my research, the Catskill has always gone in waves of, like, it seemed like there was something about to happen and it was about to have a renaissance of some sorts, but then it would just go down, you know, it would stop. And it was quiet. It was very, there's Main Street, there was not many businesses going on. There were a lot of empty shops. And then from the pandemic on, now we see a bustling Main Street. We see all the shops are being utilized. And I would travel here to Hudson, and Warren Street was also, it was bustling. It was definitely, there was liveliness. I remember coming to Hudson and being like, wow, this is like the village in lots of ways. Greenwich Village of New York City. But it expanded. It's more, even more so now. A lot of people moved up here from the pandemic and took out all those shops and, you know, took the shops out, bought the shops in Catskill as well. So, yeah, I think that's where I could see the difference from 2013, 2016, to 2020, and now after 2020. It's definitely a different vibe and energy. Although, I will say that unlike many people who just move into a town willy-nilly without doing research. I did research on Catskill, and I became very locally involved, where people don't do that. They come into a place and they stay in their bubble with their businesses or their lives. I threw myself into learning about the people who were from here and becoming friends with people who grew up here generationally. And so I got to learn a little bit more about the culture of Hudson and Catskill.
When you think about the community of Catskill and of Hudson, who do you include in that conception of community?
I include, obviously, the people who are generationally from the area, and then the people who move in but become involved in the culture. Those are the people I include. The people I don't include are people who exclude themselves, who are vocal online on a community board, but you don't see them active in any other aspect of living in either Hudson or Catskill. To me, they exclude themselves, so they're not to be included, right? I include the people that I talk with and that want to help each other, the community. Yeah, so yes, I guess that's I include the community, people, the community members. I love meeting people who, I guess I never said this. I also occasionally work as a doorman at the Avalon Lounge, which is in Catskill. It's a Korean restaurant / live music / nightclub. Live music hall / nightclub, and I occasionally work there maybe twice a month. For me, that's it's my way of like still staying involved in the music scene, which I grew up on, and I get to see young and old people come out, and I sit at the door and I check IDs and I just make sure that they're okay to come in and okay when they're leaving. So I get that vibrancy of interaction in a club setting or a restaurant setting and nightlife setting. And I love when people are there and they say, oh, I just moved here. And I'm able to say, oh, you need to come to the village board meetings or you need to see. And you see an interest spark in that. That to me is like engaging. That's to me is involving someone to come into community and to be engaged in the community and to understand that there is community, and that we do look out for each other in some ways, you know, and we try to help each other. So that to me is, I guess that's the exciting part for me of that.
You talked about the displacement that you've seen happen, especially during the pandemic. And I wonder just how that displacement impacts your sense of home in the place that you live.
It's discouraging. When you see that happen, it's discouraging. It makes me feel badly. It makes me feel like, man, what can we do better to awaken some people to recognize that we're losing people here? You know, when we, the organization I work with, ACAC, were fighting for a bill to be passed called Good Cause Eviction, which allows landlords, it protects tenants from being evicted from their place without the landlord having good cause. So, it protects them in the sense that They can't just be evicted because I want to put another person in here immediately, or, you know, I want to keep it empty. You know, like, they have to have a good reason for evicting the person. And when we tried to fight for that in Hudson and Catskill, I noticed that a lot of people didn't understand the law, and that meant that we weren't putting out more good information, or we weren't explaining it better. At first, people were against it, and then the resolutions got passed in both Hudson and Catskill. Those were significant wins for us. Unfortunately, you know, just the reaction of the community, some of the community members, those with louder voices, I should say, and even though their numbers were smaller, it also showed kind of the disproportionate, historical disproportionate of disproportion of people who held power in Catskill and Hudson, and how they weren't concerned about the displacement of their neighbors that they grew up with, because they were sitting comfortably in the area. That was probably one of the most eye-awakening moments for me, is to see that, and you know, to see that happen, and to see that it was people who sat in the political field, sat on the Republican or Democratic side. It was coming from both ends, and it was just, and that was an eye-awakening for me. That was like a moment of like, wow, these are people who want to protect, and or say they want to protect, or say that they're believe in democracy and the democratic way, and yet they're doing that. You know, like, they're hurting their neighbors. That was, I think that was probably I think that was what I felt the most. Like, I felt that it was just sad to see that. And I was very vocal about it. I'm not allowed on the Catskill Village Community Board anymore because I got thrown off of the community board because the person who ran it at the time, or still runs it at the time, he didn't like the way I was saying things, because I would come after people. I'm like, you're acting like an elitist. And he was like, oh, you're causing trouble. Meanwhile, other people say certain similar things, but I would call it out as elitist. And because I used the word elitist, then I was thrown off of the community board, because I pointed out, and I gave it a name. I gave it a label. But it's fine by me. It's sad, but it's fine by me to not be able to communicate or to be vocal on a community board, but that's social media, so.
Do you think that was racially motivated?
Oh, most definitely. And the reason that I know it was, because I spoke with other people of color who would say things similar to me, and they were also kicked off the board, or they were scolded by this person who runs the community board online. You know, it definitely pointed towards racism. And it's clear that it is, you know. We, especially Greene County, but also Columbia County, are two counties that are, they call it the old boys club, and it is definitely the old boys club. I've gotten in a position where I can rub shoulders with those old boys, and I guess a certain amount of respect, but because of the color of my skin, because I'm very vocal about black liberation, it's with an arm's length, you know? So, but that's okay too, because I hold power in my voice, and I hold power within a community that does that is together here and wants to see change. So I'm not scared. They're not running me off. Yeah.
Could you maybe just tell me the story of what brought you to HCHC in terms of, yeah, like the events that brought you here and also the kind of motivation to do this work?
Well, I believe I had said this in our first part of the interview, but in 2020, during the pandemic, there were a bunch of us that wanted to start a micro farm on Spring Street in Catskill. And it is in an area of Catskill that there are they call it up the hill. It's from the east side of Spring Street going towards the Hudson River. They're bigger houses. It's an R1 zone, so they're single family homes. Even though these homes are really big, they could be easily made into multi-unit apartments. They could be easily made into having one or even two unit houses on the lands. So we started doing that, and we had a few people come up to us who lived in that area. I would be remiss of me to say that they were all on the Democratic Party, the Catskill Democratic Party. And I had people come up to us and say, what type of people are going to come here? And now this is during the pandemic. This is also during George Floyd. So there is a wave of we understand that racism exists, especially towards black men. And then to have people from the Democratic Party with lawn signs that say, in this house, we believe that all Black Lives Matter. But then they would come up to me and say, what type of people are going to be in on this land? And it's just like, that was another moment of an eye-opening moment for me. And I started becoming very vocal about that online on the community board when I was still allowed. And a few people from the Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition were recognizing what I was saying and how I was saying it. And how I went back down from an argument, I would continue. And then I started opening Megan Heavy has started the Catskill Food Pantry, and I was helping her along with that. And I started the disparaging numbers of families not being able to have access to food, especially up the mountain, we call it, which is like Tannersville, Hunter, Windham. That was another eye-opening moment. But before that, working with Kasaki Logistics Medical Transport and traveling all over Greene and Columbia County, and especially veterans who I was bringing to the vet's hospital in Albany and hearing their stories, listening to their stories while I was driving, I just recognized how social, economic, and racism were being used as tools to separate people and to pit people against each other. And Claire Cousin, who was the executive director of Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition, reached out to me and she was like, we like what you're saying. We like how your energy, and would you want to be part of this Black-led organization? And I was just like, wow, that's, yeah, I would love that. I was still finishing my studies at Bard College. So I was kind of had them on hold for a little bit. But as more things were happening with our political landscape here, I just had to come in. And even at the end of my final year at Bard, I started working, and I was like, okay, let's get on this. I think that's what brought me to the work. But also, again, I think it was also that I had thrown myself into the local community scene, the people who were generationally here. I knew a lot of them. So they also saw that, you know, like, and I think that that was appreciated, because people come here and they start doing their own thing and they're not really engaging with the people who have been raised and born here, you know, and that's so important. And it made me realize, like, I didn't do that when I was in Amsterdam. You know, it's a big city, first of all, so it's a little bit harder to do. The Dutch are also a culture that, well, you're not really from here, so, you know, arm's length, you know, we don't really want you involved here as much. And so, yeah, I think that that was appreciated by Quentin Quas, Claire Cousin, Tiffany Guerra. You know, I think that they just saw that and they were, yeah, they were pleased to have me on board, so.
I wonder if you could tell me about something that you've learned from somebody who grew up in this community.
I learned a lot from Quentin Quas and Claire Cousin. And one of the things that I learned is that from them is continue to use your voice, which I always did, but they confirmed it. But also recognize that if you're trying to help community, you have to also use your voice wisely. Don't, because I could blurt out the craziest idea. Like, I could really blurt it out. And they were like, okay, curb that. You know, like, that's what I learned from them. Because everyone around here has their own stories and their own viewpoints on things. So, you know, try to be a little bit more diplomatic in the way that you present. And especially because you're representing an organization. So that's one of the things I definitely learned from both of them. And I guess I also learned from them is our elected officials are people just like us. And it's something that in Vermont, when I met Bernie, it was like, that's Bernie Sanders, or that's Pat Leahy. Like, it was like, you know, and here it's like, that's Michelle Hinchey, and she deserves respect, but she's also a person just like you and me, and you know, or that's Mayor Kamal Johnson. Like, it was just Joe Ferris. It was just, they're regular people, and you could talk to them, and that's one of the things I definitely learned from Quentin and Claire. Yeah.
I wonder what it felt like for you to kind of refine your voice and see its impact as you settled into your work here.
First time I've noticed that my voice and what I was saying was quite respected was at a village board meeting in Casco. And I remember that the board, I can't forget what they were talking about. It had to do with housing. And I remember that Pete Grassi, it could have been Natasha Law. One of the board members came and said, Elliot, what do you think about this? And it was just like, oh, like, my voice actually matters in this context. And to be pointed out, and it was a bit, not that the village board meetings are busy, but this one was. And I recognized that my voice mattered in that point, and my voice was respected. As much as they also are like, you know, Ellie is a and I am a troublemaker because I am an advocate. That's what I do. So, but it was respected and needed in that moment, and it made me realize that I have power here, and I need to be careful with it as well, and I need to utilize it in the right way. I can't be, you know, calling people assholes or you know, like calling them names, because that doesn't help the community. You know, Quentin taught me that one. He said, you know, when you do that, it doesn't help the community, it actually harms, right? So I think that was one of the moments where I recognized that, and I've been quite careful about how I utilize my voice and make sure that I'm utilizing it correctly, so that, you know, I don't want to get other people in the community in trouble. Like, you know, I don't want to start spewing out the rumors even without knowing the facts, you know. So, and I used to spew out the rumors even though and they end up being factual, but, you know, I didn't know that at the time. So, yeah, I've been very careful about it, but also it's great to listen. I love listening to people and love listening to the stories, and especially from elders and people who have been here for a while, like to hear the stories of how it was. And then I like to repeat those stories in a setting where, like at Avalon, and I'm meeting new people and I get to tell them the history of something that I learned, and share that history so that they can take it and it can sit with them and they can see how they maneuver, and what they give and take from the community, you know. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I feel like it did. Okay.
I think it did.
Okay.
You mentioned Good Cause eviction mm-hmm. protections, and I'm wondering if there are other kind of central pieces of advocacy work or central sort of like causes that you're focused on with your own advocacy right now?
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate goal is liberation for everyone, right? And what does that look like? What does that really truly look like? So some of these bills that are assembly people and senators are working on are important towards that liberation. For instance, like the REST Act, which is like the second part of Good Cause, which is rent stabilization, which we now see it happening in New York City, and why not see it in the rest of the state? Today I was talking to someone from, a representative from Galvin Bard, that iteration of Galvin and Bard together. And the person who I was speaking to worked in housing for many years, and I was telling them about having an open conversation about social housing and what does social housing look like, what does cooperatives look like, you know. And the person was very kind of like trying to be a bit, and I use these with air quotes, realistic. And I don't like when people say, oh, you have to be real about this, because real is what we, for me, real is what we know as in this realm. But I like to dream and think outside of that realm and think about what could be, and then try to, how can we get there, and think about these avenues and everything. So social housing, you know, rent stabilization leads towards that. Rent stabilization, we right now are in a period where rents are simply not affordable. But we're talking about housing, a roof over a person's head. How did that become a commodity? And then you think about the times of serfdoms, and you think about that, and you're like, okay, this is where it became a commodity. I have land, then I'm going to share this land with you, but you're going to have to pay me for this land, and, you know, for what I'm sharing with you. And, you know, it's important that we look at that. It's important that we look at the making housing commodity, or how it became a commodity, and why is it a commodity? Same as food. I love buying from local farms. I sit on the committee for the Catskill Farmers Market. I told you about my work at the Onion River Co-op in Vermont, and that being a very amazing experience for me to learn about quality, food quality, and the chemicals that are put into foods, and the non-GMOs, and how that affects our bodies, how that affects our lives. That food is very important to me. Power authority. Right now, there's a bill written by Sarah Hanna Threshla and Michelle Hinchy, and it's the public takeover of Central Hudson. So we're looking at, next week, we're going to be doing a town hall in Catskill at the Catskill Theater about what does that look like. And I love conversations about what does that look like. That's me. That's like, let's talk about it. Let's have a conversation. People are like, oh, but that means that it's going to be state run, and look how the state runs things. But you know what? New York is a very progressive state. And as much as we want to complain about things, like, we have it good in lots of ways, you know? It could be better. And that's what we're trying to strive for. So that's a bill that we are actively working on. Clean slate. You know, we have millions of people who are incarcerated in New York State for low-level crimes. So the Clean Slate bill allows a person who's been out of jail, prison, 4 to 11 years without any sort of arrest. It expunges their records. Not expunges, but it hides it from a person getting housing, a person wanting to get a loan for going to college. You know, these are things that, you know, they should be able to do, especially if from 4 to 11 years they've had no infractions on their records. You know, why are we perpetually baking hands of people who did a crime when they were a young kid? You know, sorry about that. These are bills that all lead towards, like, liberation of everyone. It starts with Black liberation, because we look at African American history, we see that it is the longest running disparagement and the people who have been attacked the most and are still being attacked, and so it starts there, but it's for everyone. So those are bills that we're looking at and that we're fighting for, and there are going to be many more. There's going to be many more. I'll refer to that Sylvia Rivera remark that I made to you, where she stood up and she's like, 69 was my first fight, and this is not going to be my last. I kind of think of that moment, you know? So, yeah.
I wonder if you could tell me what it felt like here in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd.
First of all, the killing of George Floyd, there were community members, community leaders who did a George Floyd march in Catskill, in the village of Catskill. And I was amazed at the number of people that showed up. I was actually really amazed. I have a story that I probably shouldn't tell that I'm going to tell. At the time, there sat a person on the village board who charismatic man, and he and I went out to a new cidery that had opened up in Catskill, and they called him the mayor of Catskill, but he was the village board president at the time. And we sat at a table and we were having a couple of ciders, And ACAC, this is before I even knew of ACAC, or I just learned about ACAC, has sat in front of the village board asking them to paint Black Lives Matter a mural on the side of a building called the Mermaid Cafe. And they were denied that by this village board. And the village board president and I were at the cidery and we were drinking. And I brought it up and I was just like, why did you ever deny that? And he's like, this is why. And he shows me his phone. And on the phone, there's a picture of a round table. And there's all these different types of guns on the table. And there's all these, you just see the, from the torso down, of men standing around the table. And the text message attached to that picture said, if you give those N-words what we want, we'll come after you. I said, why don't you go public with this? And he was just like, he's like, I know these people. Like, he's like, you know what I mean? Never came public with it until now. And it was a moment where it scared me. It scared me for him. It scared me for the Black community here. And yeah, so I forget your question.
Just what it felt like in the aftermath.
So that was part of the it. Like that made me realize, like, we live in this kind of Proud Boy kind of country, this area of where there is this, you know. And then I started doing the research and I learned about the Ku Klux Klan having like history in the Catskill Mountains, you know. And then you see that, sadly you see, like, you know, what's happening in Palestine, and you see this occupation, and you're putting this all together, and you're like, wow, there's this really serious, deeply rooted racism globally. It's global. It's global. When I lived in, and then I start reflecting on Amsterdam and my experiences in Amsterdam, I'm like, oh, the segregation. But I'm looking at the segregation, and I'm looking at, it's the Muslim community that's segregated. It's the Somalian community that's segregated. You know, and I'm thinking about this, and I'm seeing the patterns here, right? And that was a huge wake-up call for me about where I'm living in. I didn't get that before the pandemic when I was driving around and listening to these vets, and the vets were saying, it's either going to be Trump or Bernie, but I'm not going to vote for Hillary. You know, like, I wasn't getting it then. But then I did get it during the George Floyd and then afterwards. I will say that the pandemic brought a certain demographic of white people from this city who voted Democrat. And it kind of gave us a little bit more power, especially with the organizations like CCSM, like ACAC, but you do see more power going towards CCSM because lighter-skinned people have more proximity to whiteness. So you see more people wanting to be involved with that, and they don't recognize the racism in that. They don't recognize that, and that's really sad.
Just for the record, could you clarify what CCSM is?
Oh, CCSM is the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement.
Okay.
And they are rent from us here in the our office. They're an amazing migrant rights group, and they do a lot of advocacy and a lot of, like, ESL classes that happen in this very room. Like, it's amazing what they do. So that's who CCSM is. But like I said, you know, we see this wave of migrant rights happening, and people who were kind of interested in working with us, but because we're so Black liberation forward, they go over to CCSM. We're safer. It's like, oh, we're helping the migrants. You know, it's this kind of like white saviorism that happens. But they don't recognize it. And when I say it, they don't like it. They don't like to hear it. But I do. But it's not going to stop me from saying it. Like, I have to say it because it needs to keep. There was this one person in Catskill. He was amazing, but also problematic. But he would say, Elliot, I love how you just keep repeating yourself. He's like, it's so important to keep repeating yourself. And I was, you know, I took that from him, Scott. Yeah, I took that from him, but.
I wonder if you have a sense of what your younger self in your early 20s coming up would think about your life now.
It's funny. I don't know. I don't know. I wonder if I would like myself now. I was a different person then, also not too different. I take myself more seriously now than I did then, obviously. And I think it's because of all my traveling that I've done, and I see how people are treating each other. I was kind of oblivious to that growing up. I didn't think of it. And when I think back now, it was there. There were moments where it was obvious, but I didn't think too much about it. I have a great story about my mother, my adoptive mother, who I grew up with, my mom. We were traveling to Coney Island, and we were visiting family. My mom drove a 1979 Brown Nova, and I can still see it now, 4-door. And I was sitting in the passenger seat, she was driving, and I may have been maybe 7 or 8. And we were approaching Coney Island. I'm not sure if we were Howard Beach or like Bay Ridge, somewhere near that vicinity. And there was a McDonald's, and it was set back with a huge parking lot, and there was a telephone booth. It wasn't not a booth, but it was one of those, like, it wasn't an actual, like, you could stand inside the booth, but it was like a stand with the telephone. And there was a black man on the phone, and he was getting beaten up by 5 white guys. And I remember seeing them punching him and kicking him and everything. And my mom went into the parking lot, and she took off her earrings. They were gold earrings. And she took off her gold rings. She threw them under the mat, and she said, "You stay here." And she opened her door, and she locked it, and she closed the door, and she ran towards this group of guys beating up this black man. And they ran. They scattered. And she, I remember her carrying this young black guy, and I remember his blood all over, and she brought him into the McDonald's, and I sat in the car. I believe the window was slightly open, because I remember hearing the sounds, the police and the things, and I don't know, I remember her coming back, and she was worked up, and she put her jewelry back on, and we just kept going. And it was just like, it was this moment of like, my mom was from the streets. and we lived, I remember just, we're living on Long Island, we're living in the suburbia, and I saw the street come out in her. And I was like, oh man, she is not to be, like, I was amazed and enamored by that, like, just how she stood up for this guy who was outnumbered and being beaten up. And that moment always stays with me as far as like fighting for others, sticking up for people. Yeah, I think that was a very important imprint on who I am.
Thank you for that story. It's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah.
Did you ever talk about it with her?
Yeah. I remember talking to her about it, and she was just like, he was outnumbered, and I don't even know what he did. I don't even care. She's like, they were going to kill him, and I was not going to let that happen.
You mentioned after the recorder was off the last time we talked that you were adopted, and we don't have to talk about that, but I wonder if there's anything you'd like to put down on the record about that experience.
That's a whole other story. Yeah. I mean, my parents got me from the New York Foundling Hospital. I can still see it. It's right across the street from where St. Vincent's was. I forget the name of the hospital now. It's on 13th, on 12th, and 6th, 7th. And New York Foundling Hospital, I can still see the words on it. Because they adopted me when I was maybe a year or at least 11 months. We would have to go back there years later. My birth mother was 16 when she had me, and when she turned 18, she wanted a custody of me. So there was a custody battle that lasted from the time that I was, I guess, 2 or 3 until I was 11 or 12. There was that long of a custody battle. And it was because I was under foster care. But the foster care laws in New York State were really bad at that time. They were not really, there was no shape to them, I guess. So my parents, who were living in the Bronx, right next to the Whitestone Bridge on Lafayette Avenue, they took me and my sister, and they moved us out to Long Island. So the foster New York Foundling Hospital felt like my parents were kind of like moving me away from my birth mother. But they were, because they wanted to put us into, like, give us a little bit of a lifestyle, like living and not in the Bronx and Lafayette Avenue, which now I go back there, I'm like, wow, this would have been amazing to grow up here. My sister grew up there until she was 13, but or 11. So, or 13, actually, 13, yeah. My birth mother also was a heroin user, and I believe, from what I understand, she contracted HIV through needle use, so her health was always bad. She had 5 kids, each with a different father, but she still wanted custody of me, you know. What I learned later on was that my mother and my father, my adoptive parents, wanted to adopt her as well. They wanted her to, like, live with them at least, and that was one of their suggestions to the Foundling Hospital. But my birth mother didn't want that. But it was a kind of a very interesting experience with that. Because I was also, while my parents were trying to get custody of me, my mother, my adoptive mother, was also not at the time diagnosed, but she was bipolar. So there, I was under a lot of abuse at the time, mostly psychological, but also physical. But the physical things never showed to the lawyers and everything like that. So, it was a really weird childhood just because of that experience. In third grade, my name changed from Elliot Padro, which was my mother's maiden name, to Elliot Matos, which is my father, my adopted father's last name. So being in school and having to explain that, you know, in third grade, that was a big thing too. So, yeah, so that was a... Growing up, I never really wanted any sort of... anything to do with my birth mother because of all that I had to go through with that custody battle. I resented her, and at the same time resented my parents because of the abuse that I was experiencing while that was all going on. So it took me a long time to forgive both sets of parents, or my birth mother and my adopted parents. It took me a long time, a lot of therapy, girl. It took a lot of therapy. But then I realized, like, and I think that this is one of the things that I recognize, is that they had their histories. They had their stories. Learning about my mom, my adoptive mom, having, she was the eldest of three brothers, and she was 14, raising three kids because my grandfather was off gallivanting with work and then having mistresses all over. So my grandmother had to work in a cafeteria all the time at a school and was, like, you know, working all day. So my mother had to take care of her three youngest brothers, and then the youngest one died from polio, but they didn't understand that it was polio. So they blamed my mother, and then they put her into a all-girls school. And my mother escaped the all-girls school and then lived on the streets of Manhattan. You see what I'm saying? Like, I was able to place that and recognize that there's a, even though she was wrong in the way that she conducted herself, my sister and myself, we also have the place that she also has a childhood that comes with that. So, yeah. So, that was my childhood. That was my growing. You know.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And also, for sharing, like, the generous perspective that you've come around to. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah. I wasn't always this little about it. I could break down and cry at any point when I had to talk about it. But, you know, and then I learned about my birth mother, my half-sisters, my sisters. They got in touch with me when I was living in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. And they're like, just to let you know, her name is Nivea. Nivea's on her deathbed. And they said, we think hearing your voice would be the most amazing gift that she would want. And I sat with it for a day, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And she just begged forgiveness for something that wasn't even her fault. She was 16 and taken advantage of by a 21-year-old boy, you know. And then because he was black, her grandmother didn't want her to have me. You know, so, like, she didn't even have a choice at 16. I was taken away from her arms, you know. So I think, you know, I give that perspective, and I'm like, wow, she, you know. But then you think about it with everyone, you really just don't know their stories, right? So you have to kind of come from a place of forgiveness, and immediately, like, wow, like, so, you know.
Because you mentioned a while ago that you like to dream, I wonder if you could tell me about your utopian vision for your community.
I see a community that is cooperative. I see a community that things are bartered or there's less money exchanged. I see people helping each other with everything, with every aspect, with taking care of your baby, taking care of your kitten, taking care of your house. Like, everyone's helping each other. That's really my, like, ultimate dream. I know this is, you know, a utopian dream, but and I think it's obtainable if we were to just, if we look at inward and we look at ourselves and we, and then that's just something that I try to do with myself. And I'm like, I always say, okay, I'm not going to say this because that could hurt a person. That could, you know, but I also have to stand in truth. So how do I say it in a way that's, you know, with love? So I try to do that. And I think more people need to try to do that. But I can't, I have to just live by example. So I have to work on it first with me, you know. So that's what I try to do. But it's difficult too. Because you live in this world where there's all these dogmas and traditions and these ways of being that have been, who, you know, centuries and centuries of, like, so deeply embedded and deeply rooted in us. And to undo that, unpack that, it's really difficult. But I still dream that it's attainable. So, yeah.
What have I missed in my questions?
Girl, I feel like we're going to do all of it. I don't think we missed anything. Like, I told my whole life story in lots of ways, so, yeah.
Well, we can always do part three next year.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah. Yeah.
Elliot, thank you so much.
Thank you. For this conversation. I appreciate that. Thank you.